6. December 1974. The face that came in answer to Todd's insistent finger on the bell was haggard and yellowed. The hair, which had been lush in July, had now begun to recede from the bony brow. It looked lusterless and brittle. Dussander's body, thin to begin with, was now gaunt. Although Todd thought he was nowhere near as gaunt as the inmates who had once been delivered into his hands. Todd's left hand had been behind his back when Dussander came to the door. Now he brought it out and handed a wrapped package to Dussander. "Merry Christmas!" he yelled. Dussander had cringed from the box. Now he took it with no expression of pleasure or surprise. He handled it gingerly, as if it might contain explosive. Beyond the porch it was raining. It had been raining on and off for almost a week, and Todd had carried the box inside his coat. It was wrapped in gay foil and ribbon. "What is it?" Dussander asked without enthusiasm as they went to the kitchen. "Open it and see." Todd took a can of Coke from his jacket pocket and put it on the red and white checked oilcloth that covered the kitchen table. "Better pull down the shades," he said confidentially. Distrust immediately leaked onto Dussander's face. "Oh, why?"
"Well, you can never tell who's looking," Todd said, smiling. "Isn't that how you got along all these years? By seeing the people who might be looking before they saw you?"
Dussander pulled down the kitchen shades. Then he poured himself a glass of bourbon. Then he pulled the bow off the package. Todd had wrapped it the way boys so often wrap Christmas packages, boys who have more important things on their minds, things like football and street hockey and the Friday night creature feature you'll watch with a friend who's sleeping over, the two of you wrapped in a blanket and crammed together on one end of the couch laughing. There were a lot of ragged corners, a lot of uneven seams, a lot of scotch tape. It spoke of impatience with such a womanly thing. Dussander was a little touched in spite of himself. And later, when the horror had receded a little, he thought, "I should have known." It was a uniform, an SS uniform, complete with jackboots. He looked numbly from the contents of the box to its cardboard cover, Peter's Quality Costume Clothiers, at the same location since 1951. "No," he said softly. "I won't put it on. This is where it ends, boy. I'll die before I put it on." "Remember what they did to Eichmann," Todd said solemnly. "He was an old man, and he had no politics. Isn't that what you said? Besides, I saved the whole fall for it. It cost over $80 with the boots thrown in. You didn't mind wearing it in 1944 either, not at all."
"You little bastard!"
Dussander raised one fist over his head. Todd didn't flinch at all. He stood his ground, eyes shining. "Yeah," he said softly. "Go ahead and touch me. You just touch me once." Dussander lowered the hand. His lips were quivering.
"You are a fiend from hell," he muttered.
"Put it on," Todd invited. Dussander's hands went to the tie of his robe and paused there. His eyes, sheep-like and begging, looked into Todd's.
"Please," he said. "I am an old man. No more."
Todd shook his head slowly but firmly. His eyes were still shining. He liked it when Dussander begged, the way they must have begged him once, the inmates at Patin. Dussander let the robe fall to the floor and stood naked except for his slippers and his boxer shorts. His chest was sunken, his belly slightly bloated. His arms were scrawny, old man's arms. "But the uniform," Todd thought, "the uniform will make a difference." Slowly, Dussander took the tunic out of the box and began to put it on. 10 minutes later, he stood fully dressed in the SS uniform. The cap was slightly askew, the shoulders slumped, but still the death's head insignia stood out clearly. Dussander had a dark dignity, at least in Todd's eyes, that he had not possessed earlier. In spite of his slump, in spite of the cockeyed angle of his feet, Todd was pleased.
For the first time, Dusander looked to Todd as Todd believed he should look. Older, yes, defeated, certainly, but in uniform again. Not an old man spinning away his sunset years watching Lawrence Welk on a cruddy black-and-white TV with tinfoil on the rabbit ears, but Kurt Dusander, the blood fiend of Patin. As for Dusander, he felt disgust, discomfort, and a mild, sneaking sense of relief. He partly despised this latter emotion, recognizing it as the truest indicator yet of the psychological domination the boy had established over him. He was the boy's prisoner, and every time he found he could live through yet another indignity, every time he felt that mild relief, the boy's power grew. 7. January 1975. Todd left school by himself after the last bell, got his bike, and pedaled down to the park. He found a deserted bench, set his Schwinn up on its kickstand, and took his report card out of his hip pocket. He took a look around to see if there was anyone in the area he knew, but the only other people in sight were two high school kids making out by the pond and a pair of gross-looking winos passing a paper bag back and forth. Dirty fucking winos, he thought. But it wasn't the winos that had upset him. He opened his card. English C. American History, C. Earth Science, D. Your community and you, B. Primary French, F. Beginning Algebra, F. He stared at the grades, unbelieving. He had known it was going to be bad, but this was disaster. Maybe that's best, an inner voice spoke up suddenly. Maybe you even did it on purpose because a part of you wants it to end, needs for it to end, before something bad happens. He shoved the thought roughly aside. Nothing bad was going to happen. Dusander was under his thumb, totally under his thumb. The old man thought one of Todd's friends had a letter, but he didn't know which friend. If anything happened to Todd, anything, that letter would go to the police. Once he supposed Dusander might have tried it anyway. Now he was too old to run, even with a head start. He's under control, damn it, Todd whispered, and then pounded his thigh hard enough to make the muscle knot. Talking to yourself was bad shit. Crazy people talk to themselves. He had picked up the habit over the last 6 weeks or so and didn't seem able to break it. He'd caught several people looking at him strangely because of it. A couple of them had been teachers, and that asshole Bernie Everson had come right out and asked him if he was going fruit crackers. Todd had come very, very close to punching the little pansy in the mouth, and that sort of stuff, brawl, scuffles, punch-outs, was no good. That sort of stuff got you noticed in all the wrong ways. Talking to yourself was bad, right, okay, but the dreams are bad, too, he whispered. He didn't catch himself that time. Just lately, the dreams had been very bad. In the dreams, he was always in uniform, although the type varied. Sometimes it was a paper uniform, and he was standing in line with hundreds of gaunt men. The smell of burning was in the air, and he could hear the choppy roar of bulldozer engines. Then Dusander would come up the line, pointing out this one or that one. They were left. The others were marched away toward the crematoriums. Some of them kicked and struggled, but most were too undernourished, too exhausted. Then Dusander was standing in front of Todd. Their eyes met for a long, paralyzing moment, and then Dusander leveled a faded umbrella at Todd. "Take this one to the laboratories," Dusander said in the dream. His lip curled back to reveal his false teeth. "Take this American boy." In another dream, he wore an SS uniform. His jack boots were shined to a mirror-like reflecting surface. The death's head insignia and the lightning bolts glittered. But he was standing in the middle of Santo Donato Boulevard, and everyone was looking at him. They began to point. Some of them began to laugh. Others looked shocked, angry, or revolted. In this dream, an old car came to a squalling, creaky halt, and Dusander peered out at him, a Dusander who looked 200 years old and nearly mummified, his skin a yellowed scroll. "I know you," the dream, Dusander proclaimed shrilly. He looked around at the spectators and then back to Todd. You were in charge at Patin. Look, everybody, this is the blood fiend of Patin, Himmler's efficiency expert. I denounce you, murderer. I denounce you, butcher. I denounce you, killer of infants. I denounce you.
In yet another dream, he wore a striped convict's uniform and was being led down a stone-walled corridor by two guards who looked like his parents. Both wore conspicuous yellow armbands with the Star of David on them. Walking behind them was a minister, reading from the Book of Deuteronomy. Todd looked back over his shoulder and saw that the minister was Dusander, and he was wearing the black tunic of an SS officer. At the end of the stone corridor, double doors opened on an octagonal room with glass walls. There was a scaffold in the center of it. Behind the glass wall stood ranks of emaciated men and women, all naked, all watching with the same dark, flat expression. On each arm was a blue number.
It's all right, Todd whispered to himself. It's okay, really. Everything's under control.
A couple that had been making out glanced over at him. Todd stared at them fiercely, daring them to say anything. At last they looked back the other way. Had the boy been grinning? Todd got up, jammed his report card into his hip pocket, and mounted his bike. He pedaled down to a drugstore 2 blocks away. There he bought a bottle of ink eradicator and a fine-point pen that dispensed blue ink. He went back to the park. The make-out couple was gone, but the winos were still there, stinking the place up. And changed his English grade to a B, American history to A, earth science to B, primary French to C, and beginning algebra to B. Your community and you he eradicated and then simply wrote in again, so the card would have a uniform look.
Uniforms, right. Never mind, he whispered to himself. That'll hold them. That'll hold them, all right.
One night late in the month, sometime after 2 o'clock, Kurt Dusander awoke, struggling with the bedclothes, gasping and moaning, into a darkness that seemed close and terrifying. He felt half suffocated, paralyzed with fear. It was as if a heavy stone lay on his chest, and he wondered if he could be having a heart attack. He clawed in the darkness for the bedside lamp and almost knocked it off the nightstand, turning it on.
I'm in my own room, he thought. My own bedroom. Here in Santo Donato, here in California, here in America. See, the same brown drapes pulled across the same window, the same bookshelves filled with dime paperbacks from the bookshop on Soren Street. Same gray rug, same blue wallpaper. No heart attack. No jungle. No eyes.
But the terror still clung to him, like a stinking pelt. And his heart went on racing. The dream had come back. He had known that it would, sooner or later, if the boy kept on. The cursed boy. He thought the boy's letter of protection was only a bluff, and not a very good one at that, something he had picked up from the TV detective programs. What friend would the boy trust not to open such a momentous letter? No friend. That was who. Or so he thought. If he could be sure. His hands closed with an arthritic, painful snap, and then opened slowly. He took the packet of cigarettes from the table and lit one, scratching the wooden match on the bedpost. The clock's hand stood at 2:41. There would be no more sleep for him this night. He inhaled smoke and then coughed it out in a series of racking spasms. No more sleep. Unless he wanted to go downstairs and have a drink or two. Or three. And there had been altogether too much drinking over the last 6 weeks or so. He was no longer a young man who could toss them off one after the other, the way he had when he had been an officer on leave in Berlin in 39, when the scent of victory had been in the air, and everywhere you heard the Führer's voice, saw his blazing, commanding eyes. The boy. The cursed boy.
Be honest, he said aloud, and the sound of his own voice in the quiet room made him jump a little. He was not in the habit of talking to himself, but neither was it the first time he had ever done so. He remembered doing it off and on during the last few weeks at Patin, when everything had come down around their ears, and in the east the sound of Russian thunder grew louder, first every day, and then every hour. It had been natural enough to talk to himself then. He had been under stress, and people under stress often do strange things, cup their testicles through the pockets of their pants, click their teeth together. Wolf had been a great teeth clicker. He grinned as he did it. Hoffman had been a finger snapper and a thigh patter, creating fast, intricate rhythms that he seemed utterly unaware of. He, Kurt Dusander, had sometimes talked to himself. But now, "You are under stress again," he said aloud. He was aware that he had spoken in German this time. He hadn't spoken German in many years. But the language now seemed warm and comfortable. It lulled him, eased him. It was sweet and dark. "Yes, you are under stress because of the boy. But be honest with yourself. It is too early in the morning to tell lies. You have not entirely regretted talking. At first you were terrified that the boy could not or would not keep his secret. He would have to tell a friend, who would tell another friend, and that friend would tell too. But if he has kept it this long, he will keep it longer. If I am taken away, he loses his talking book. Is that what I am to him? I think so." He fell silent, but his thoughts went on. He had been lonely. No one would ever know just how lonely. There had been times when he thought almost seriously of suicide. He made a bad hermit. The voices he heard came from the radio. The only people who visited were on the other side of a dirty glass square. He was an old man, and although he was afraid of death, he was more afraid of being an old man who was alone. His bladder sometimes tricked him. He would be halfway to the bathroom when a dark stain spread on his pants. In wet weather, his joints would first throb and then begin to cry out, and there had been days when he had chewed an entire tin of arthritis pain formula between sunrise and sunset, and still the aspirin only subdued the aches. Even such acts as taking a book from the shelf or switching the TV channel became an essay in pain. His eyes were bad. Sometimes he knocked things over, barked his shins, bumped his head. He lived in fear of breaking a bone and not being able to get to the telephone. And he lived in fear of getting there and having some doctor uncover his real past as he became suspicious of Mr. Denker's non-existent medical history. The boy had alleviated some of those things. When the boy was here, he could call back the old days. His memory of those days was perversely clear. He spilled out a seemingly endless catalogue of names and events, even the weather of such and such a day. He remembered Private Henried, who manned a machine gun in the northeast tower, and the when Private Henried had between his eyes. Some of the men called him Three Eyes, or Old Cyclops. He remembered Kessel, who had a picture of his girlfriend naked, lying on a sofa with her hands behind her head. Kessel charged the men to look at it. He remembered the names of the doctors and their experiments, thresholds of pain, the brainwaves of dying men and women, physiological retardation, effects of different sorts of radiation, dozens more, hundreds more. He supposed he talked to the boy as all old men talk. But he guessed he was luckier than most old men, who had impatience, disinterest, or outright rudeness for an audience. His audience was endlessly fascinated. Were a few bad dreams too high a price to pay? He crushed out his cigarette, lay looking at the ceiling for a moment, and then swung his feet out onto the floor. He and the boy were loathsome, he supposed, feeding off each other, eating each other. If his own belly was sometimes sour with the dark but rich food they partook of in his afternoon kitchen, what was the boy's like? Did he sleep well? Perhaps not. Lately, Dusander thought the boy looked rather pale and thinner than when he had first come into Dusander's life. He walked across the bedroom and opened the closet door. He brushed hangers to the right, reached into the shadows, and brought out the sham uniform. It hung from his hand like a vulture skin. He touched it with his other hand, touched it, and then stroked it. After a very long time, he took it down and put it on, dressing slowly, not looking into the mirror until the uniform was completely buttoned and belted, and the sham fly zipped. He looked at himself in the mirror then, and nodded. He went back to bed, lay down, and smoked another cigarette. When it was finished, he felt sleepy again. He turned off the bed lamp, not believing it, that it could be this easy. But he was asleep 5 minutes later, and this time his sleep was dreamless. 8. February 1975. After dinner, Dick Bowden produced a cognac that Dusander privately thought dreadful. But of course he smiled broadly and complimented it extravagantly. Bowden's wife served the boy a chocolate malted. The boy had been unusually quiet all through the meal. Uneasy? Yes. For some reason the boy seemed very uneasy. Dusander had charmed Dick and Monica Bowden from the moment he and the boy had arrived. The boy had told his parents that Mr. Denker's vision was much worse than it actually was, which made poor old Mr. Denker in need of a seeing-eye dog, Dusander thought dryly, because that explained all the reading the boy had supposedly been doing. Dusander had been very careful about that, and he thought there had been no slips. He was dressed in his best suit, and although the evening was damp, his arthritis had been remarkably mellow, nothing but an occasional twinge. For some absurd reason, the boy had wanted him to leave his umbrella home, but Dusander had insisted. All in all, he had had a pleasant and rather exciting evening. Dreadful cognac or no, he had not been out to dinner in 9 years. During the meal, he had discussed the Essen Motor Works, the rebuilding of post-war Germany. Bowden had asked several intelligent questions about that and had seemed impressed by Dusander's answers. And German writers. Monica Bowden had asked him how he had happened to come to America so late in life, and Dusander, adopting the proper expression of myopic sorrow, had explained about the death of his fictitious wife. Monica Bowden was meltingly sympathetic. And now, over the absurd cognac, Dick Bowden said, "If this is too personal, Mr. Denker, please don't answer, but I couldn't help wondering what you did in the war." The boy stiffened ever so slightly. Dusander smiled and felt for his cigarettes. He could see them perfectly well, but it was important to make not the tiniest slip. Monica put them in his hand. "Thank you, dear lady. The meal was superb. You are a fine cook. My own wife never did better." Monica thanked him and looked flustered. Todd gave her an irritated look. "Not personal at all," Dusander said, lighting his cigarette and turning to Bowden. "I was in the reserves from 1943 on, as were all able-bodied men too old to be in the active services. By then the handwriting was on the wall for the Third Reich and for the madmen who created it, one madman in particular, of course." He blew out his match and looked solemn. "There was great relief when the tide turned against Hitler. Great relief, of course." And here he looked at Bowden disarmingly as man to man. One was careful not to express such a sentiment, not allowed. "I suppose not," Dick Bowden said respectfully. "No," Dusander said gravely, "not allowed. I remember one evening when four or five of us, all friends, stopped at a local Ratskeller after work for a drink. By then there was not always schnapps or even beer, but it so happened that night there were both. We had all known each other for upwards of 20 years. One of our number, Hans Hassler, mentioned in passing that perhaps the Führer had been ill-advised to open a second front against the Russians. I said, 'Hans, God in heaven, watch what you say.' Poor Hans went pale and changed the subject entirely. Yet 3 days later he was gone. I never saw him again, nor, as far as I know, did anyone else who was sitting at our table that night. How awful, Monica said breathlessly. More cognac, Mr. Denker? No, thank you, he smiled at her. My wife had a saying from her mother, one must never overdo the sublime. Todd's small, troubled frown deepened slightly. Do you think he was sent to one of the camps? Dick asked. Your friend Hessler. Hassler, Dusander corrected gently. He grew grave. Many were. The camps, they will be the shame of the German people for a thousand years to come. They are Hitler's real legacy. Oh, I think that's too harsh, Bowden said, lighting his pipe and puffing out a choking cloud of cherry blend. According to what I've read, the majority of the German people had no idea what was going on. The locals around Auschwitz thought it was a sausage plant. Oh, how terrible, Monica said, and pulled a grimacing that's enough of that expression at her husband. Then she turned to Dusander and smiled. I just love the smell of a pipe, Mr. Denker, don't you? Indeed I do, madam, Dusander said. He had just gotten an almost insurmountable urge to sneeze under control. Bowden suddenly reached across the table and clapped his son on the shoulder. Todd jumped. You're awfully quiet tonight, son. Feeling all right? Todd offered a peculiar smile that seemed divided between his father and Dusander. I feel okay. I've heard most of these stories before, remember? Todd, Monica said, that's hardly the boy. He is only being honest, Dusander said. A privilege of boys which men often have to give up. Yes, Mr. Bowden? Dick laughed and nodded. Perhaps I could get Todd to walk back to mine house with me now, Dusander said. I'm sure he has his studies. Todd is a very apt pupil, Monica said, but she spoke almost automatically, looking at Todd in a puzzled sort of way. All A's and B's, usually. He got a C this last quarter, but he's promised to bring his French up to snuff on his March report. Right, Todd, baby? Todd offered the peculiar smile again and nodded. No need for you to walk, Dick said. I'll be glad to run you back to your place. I walk for the air and the exercise, Dusander said. Really, I must insist, unless Todd prefers not to. Oh, no, I'd like a walk, Todd said, and his mother and father beamed at him. They were almost at Dusander's corner when Dusander broke the silence. It was drizzling, and he hoisted his umbrella over both of them. And yet, still, his arthritis lay quiet, dozing. It was amazing. You are like my arthritis, he said. Todd's head came up. Huh? Neither of you have had much to say tonight. What's got your tongue, boy? Cat or cormorant? Nothing, Todd muttered. They turned down Dusander's street. Perhaps I could guess, Dusander said, not without a touch of malice. When you came to get me, you were afraid I might make a slip. Let the cat out of the bag, you say here. Yet you were determined to go through with the dinner because you had run out of excuses to put your parents off. Now you are disconcerted that all went well. Is that not the truth? Who cares? Todd said, and shrugged sullenly. Why shouldn't it go well? Dusander demanded. I was dissembling before you were born. You keep a secret well enough, I give you that. I give it to you most graciously. But did you see me tonight? I charmed them. Charmed them. Todd suddenly burst out. You didn't have to do that. Dusander came to a complete stop, staring at Todd. Not do it? Not? I thought that was what you wanted, boy. Certainly they will offer no objections if you continue to come over and read to me. You're sure taking a lot for granted, Todd said hotly. Maybe I've got all I want from you. Do you think there's anybody forcing me to come over to your scuzzy house and watch you slop up booze like those old wino puss bags that hang around the old train yards? Is that what you think? His voice had risen and taken on a thin, wavering, hysterical note. Because there's nobody forcing me. If I want to come, I'll come, and if I don't, I won't. Lower your voice. People will hear. Who cares? Todd said. But he began to walk again. This time he deliberately walked outside the umbrella's span. No, nobody forces you to come, Dusander said. And then he took a calculated shot in the dark. In fact, you are welcome to stay away. Believe me, boy, I have no scruples about drinking alone, none at all. Todd looked at him scornfully. You'd like that, wouldn't you? Dusander only smiled noncommittally. Well, don't count on it. They had reached the concrete walk leading up to Dusander's stoop. Dusander fumbled in his pocket for his latchkey. The arthritis flared a dim red in the joints of his fingers, and then subsided, waiting. Now Dusander thought he understood what it was waiting for him to be alone again. Then it could come out. I'll tell you something, Todd said. He sounded oddly breathless. If they knew what you were, if I ever told them, they'd spit on you and then kick you out on your skinny old ass. Dusander looked at Todd closely in the drizzling dark. The boy's face was turned defiantly up to his, but the skin was pallid, the sockets under the eyes dark and slightly hollowed, the skin tones of someone who has brooded long while others are asleep. I am sure they would have nothing but revulsion for me, Dusander said, although he privately thought that the elder Bowden might stay his revulsion long enough to ask many of the questions his son had asked already. Nothing but revulsion. But what would they feel for you, boy, when I told them you had known about me for 8 months and said nothing? Todd stared at him, wordlessly in the dark. Come and see me, if you please, Dusander said indifferently, and stay home if you don't. Good night, boy. He went up the walk to his front door, leaving Todd standing in the drizzle and looking after him with his mouth slightly ajar. The next morning at breakfast, Monica said, Your dad liked Mr. Denker a lot, Todd. He said he reminded him of your grandfather. Todd muttered something unintelligible around his toast. Monica looked at her son and wondered if he had been sleeping well. He looked pale, and his grades had taken that inexplicable dip. Todd never got C's. Are you feeling okay these days, Todd? He looked at her blankly for a moment, and then that radiant smile spread over his face, charming her, comforting her. There was a dab of strawberry preserves on his chin. Sure, he said, 4-0. Todd, baby, she said. Monica, baby, he responded, and they both started to laugh. 9. March 1975. Kitty, kitty, Dusander said. Here, kitty, kitty. Puss, puss. Puss, puss. He was sitting on his back stoop, a pink plastic bowl by his right foot. The bowl was full of milk. It was 1:30 in the afternoon. The day was hazy and hot. Brush fires far to the west tinged the air with an autumnal smell that jagged oddly against the calendar. If the boy was coming, he would be here in another hour. But the boy didn't always come now. Instead of 7 days a week, he came sometimes only 4 times or 5. An intuition had grown in him little by little, and his intuition told him that the boy was having troubles of his own. Kitty, kitty, Dusander coaxed. The stray cat was at the far end of the yard, sitting in the ragged verge of weeds by Dusander's fence. It was a tom, and every bit as ragged as the weeds it sat in. Every time he spoke, the cat's ears cocked forward. Its eyes never left the pink bowl filled with milk. Perhaps, Dusander thought, the boy was having troubles with his studies, or bad dreams, or both. That last made him smile. Kitty, kitty, he called softly. The cat's ears cocked forward again. It didn't move, not yet, but it continued to study the milk. Dusander had certainly been afflicted with problems of his own. For 3 weeks or so, he had worn the SS uniform to bed like grotesque pajamas, and the uniform had warded off the insomnia and the bad dreams. His sleep had been, at first, as sound as a lumberjack's. Then the dreams had returned, not little by little, but all at once, and worse than ever before. Dreams of running, as well as the dreams of the eyes. Running through a wet, unseen jungle where heavy leaves and damp fronds struck his face, leaving trickles that felt like sap or blood. Running and running, the luminous eyes always around him, peering soullessly at him until he broke into a clearing. In the darkness he sensed rather than saw the steep rise that began on the clearing's far side. At the top of that rise was Patton, its low cement buildings and yards surrounded by barbed wire and electrified wire, its sentry towers standing like Martian dreadnoughts straight out of War of the Worlds. And in the middle, huge stacks billowed smoke against the sky, and below these brick columns were the furnaces, stoked and ready to go, glowing in the night like the eyes of fierce demons. They had told the inhabitants of the area that the Patton inmates made clothes and candles, and of course the locals had believed that no more than the locals around Auschwitz had believed that the camp was a sausage factory. It didn't matter. Looking back over his shoulder in the dream, he would at last see them coming out of hiding, the restless dead, the Juden, shambling toward him with blue numbers glaring from the livid flesh of their outstretched arms, their hands hooked into talons, their faces no longer expressionless, but animated with hate, lively with vengeance, vivacious with murder. Toddlers ran beside their mothers, and grandfathers were borne up by their middle-aged children, and the dominant expression on all their faces was desperation. Desperation? Yes, because in the dreams he knew, and so did they, that if he could climb the hill, he would be safe. Down here in these wet and swampy lowlands, in this jungle where the night-flowering plants extruded blood instead of sap, he was a hunted animal, prey. But up there he was in command. If this was a jungle, then the camp at the top of the hill was a zoo. All the wild animals safely in cages, he, the head keeper, whose job it was to decide which would be fed, which would live, which would be handed over to the vivisectionists, which would be taken to the knackers in the remover's van. He would begin to run up the hill, running in all the slowness of nightmare. He would feel the first skeletal hands close about his neck, feel their cold and stinking breath, smell their decay, hear their bird-like cries of triumph as they pull him down, with salvation not only in sight but almost at hand. "Kitty, kitty," Dusander called. "Milk, nice milk." The cat came at last. It crossed half of the backyard, and then sat again, but lightly, its tail twitching with worry. It didn't trust him, no. But Dusander knew the cat could smell the milk, and so he was sanguine. Sooner or later it would come. At Patton there had never been a contraband problem. Some of the prisoners came with their valuables poked far up their asses in small chamois bags. And how often their valuables turned out not to be valuable at all, photographs, locks of hair, fake jewelry, often pushed up with sticks until they were past the point where even the long fingers of the trusty they had called Stinky Thumbs could reach. One woman, he remembered, had had a small diamond, flawed, it turned out, really not valuable at all, but it had been in her family for 6 generations, passed from mother to eldest daughter, or so she said. But of course she was a Jew, and all of them lied. She swallowed it before entering Patton. When it came out in her waist, she swallowed it again. She kept doing this, although eventually the diamond began to cut her insides, and she bled. There had been other ruses, although most only involved petty items such as a hoard of tobacco or a hair ribbon or two. It didn't matter. In the room Dusander used for prisoner interrogations, there was a hot plate and a homely kitchen table covered with a red checked cloth, much like the one in his own kitchen. There was always a pot of lamb stew bubbling mellowly away on that hot plate. When contraband was suspected, and when was it not, a member of the suspected clique would be brought to that room. Dusander would stand them by the hot plate, where the rich fumes from the stew wafted. Gently he would ask them, "Who? Who is hiding gold? Who is hiding jewelry? Who has tobacco? Who gave the Givenet woman the pill for her baby? Who?" The stew was never specifically promised, but always the aroma eventually loosened their tongues. Of course, a truncheon would have done the same, or a gun barrel jammed into their filthy crotches, but the stew was elegant, yes. "Kitty, kitty," Dusanda called. The cat's ears cocked forward. It half rose, then half remembered some long-ago kick, or perhaps a match that had burned its whiskers, and it settled back on its haunches. But soon it would move. He had found a way of propitiating his nightmare. It was, in a way, no more than wearing the SS uniform, but raised to a greater power. Dusanda was pleased with himself, only sorry that he had never thought of it before. He supposed he had the boy to thank for this new method of quieting himself, for showing him that the key to the past's terrors was not in rejection, but in contemplation, and even something like a friend's embrace. It was true that before the boy's unexpected arrival last summer, he hadn't had any bad dreams for a long time. But he believed now that he had come to a coward's terms with his past. He had been forced to give up a part of himself. Now he had reclaimed it. "Kitty, kitty," called Dusanda, and a smile broke on his face. A kindly smile, a reassuring smile, the smile of all old men who have somehow come through the cruel courses of life to a safe place, still relatively intact, and with at least some wisdom. The Tom rose from its haunches, hesitated only a moment longer, and then trotted across the remainder of the backyard with lithe grace. It mounted the steps, gave Dusanda a final mistrustful look, laying back its chewed and scabby ears. Then it began to drink the milk. "Nice milk," Dusanda said, pulling on the Playtex rubber gloves that had lain in his lap all the while. "Nice milk for a nice kitty." He had bought these gloves in the supermarket. He had stood in the express lane, and older women had looked at him approvingly, even speculatively. The gloves were advertised on TV. They had cuffs. They were so flexible, you could pick up a dime while you were wearing them. He stroked the cat's back with one green finger and talked to it soothingly. Its back began to arch with the rhythm of his strokes. Just before the bowl was empty, he seized the cat. It came electrically alive in his clenching hands, twisting and jerking, clawing at the rubber. Its body lashed limberly back and forth, and Dusanda had no doubt that if its teeth or claws got into him, it would come off the winner. It was an old campaigner. It takes one to know one, Dusanda thought, grinning. Holding the cat prudently away from his body, the painful grin stamped on his face, Dusanda pushed the back door open with his foot and went into the kitchen. The cat yowled and twisted and ripped at the rubber gloves. Its feral, triangular head flashed down and fastened on one green thumb. "Nasty kitty," Dusanda said reproachfully. The oven door stood open. Dusanda threw the cat inside. Its claws made a ripping, prickly sound as they disengaged from the gloves. Dusanda slammed the oven door shut with one knee, provoking a painful twinge from his arthritis. Yet he continued to grin. Breathing hard, nearly panting, he propped himself against the stove for a moment, his head hanging down. It was a gas stove. He rarely used it for anything fancier than TV dinners and killing stray cats. Faintly, rising up through the gas burners, he could hear the cat scratching and yowling to be let out. Dusanda twisted the oven dial over to 500 degrees. There was an audible pop as the oven pilot light lit two double rows of hissing gas. The cat stopped yowling and began to scream. It sounded, yes, almost like a young boy. A young boy in terrible pain. The thought made Dusanda smile even more broadly. His heart thundered in his chest. The cat scratched and whirled madly in the oven, still screaming. Soon a hot, furry, burning smell began to seep out of the oven and into the room. He scraped the remains of the cat out of the oven half an hour later. Using a barbecue fork he had acquired for $2.98 at the Grants in the shopping center a mile away. The cat's roasted carcass went into an empty flour sack. He took the sack down cellar. The cellar floor had never been cemented. Shortly, Dusanda came back up. He sprayed the kitchen with Glade until it reeked of artificial pine scent. He opened all the windows. He washed the barbecue fork and hung it up on the pegboard. Then he sat down to wait and see if the boy would come. He smiled and smiled. Todd did come, about 5 minutes after Dusanda had given up on him for the afternoon. He was wearing a warm-up jacket with his school colors on it. He was also wearing a San Diego Padres baseball cap. He carried his school books under his arms. "Yucca ducca," he said, coming into the kitchen and wrinkling his nose. "What's that smell? It's awful." "I tried the oven," Dusanda said, lighting a cigarette. "I'm afraid I burned my supper. I had to throw it out." One day later that month, the boy came much earlier than usual, long before school usually let out. Dusanda was sitting in the kitchen, drinking ancient age bourbon from a chipped and discolored cup that had the words, "Here's your coffee, ma, ha, ha, ha," written around the rim. He had his rocker out in the kitchen now, and he was just drinking and rocking, rocking and drinking, bumping his slippers on the faded linoleum. He was pleasantly high. There had been no more bad dreams at all until just last night, not since the tomcat with the chewed ears. Last night's had been particularly horrible, though. That could not be denied. They had dragged him down after he had gotten halfway up the hill, and they had begun to do unspeakable things to him before he was able to wake himself up. Yet after his initial thrashing return to the world of real things, he had been confident. He could end the dreams whenever he wished. Perhaps a cat would not be enough this time, but there was always the dog pound. Yes, always the pound. Todd came abruptly into the kitchen, his face pale and shiny and strained. He had lost weight, all right, Dusanda thought, and there was a queer white look in his eyes that Dusanda did not like at all. "You're going to help me," Todd said suddenly and defiantly. "Really?" Dusanda said mildly, but sudden apprehension leaped inside of him. He didn't let his face change as Todd slammed his books down on the table with a sudden, vicious overhand stroke. One of them spun skated across the oilcloth and landed in a tent on the floor by Dusander's foot. "Yes, you're fucking a right," Todd said shrilly. "You better believe it, because this is your fault. All your fault." Hectic spots of red mounted into his cheeks. "But you're going to have to help me get out of it, because I've got the goods on you. I've got you right where I want you."
"I'll help you in any way I can," Dusanda said quietly. He saw that he had folded his hands neatly in front of himself without even thinking about it, just as he had once done. He leaned forward in the rocker until his chin was directly over his folded hands, as he had once done. His face was calm and friendly and inquiring. None of his growing apprehension showed. Sitting just so, he could almost imagine a pot of lamb stew simmering on the stove behind him. "Tell me what the trouble is."
"This is the fucking trouble," Todd said viciously and threw a folder at Dusanda.
It bounced off his chest and landed in his lap, and he was momentarily surprised by the heat of the anger which leaped up in him, the urge to rise and backhand the boy smartly. Instead, he kept the mild expression on his face. It was the boy's school card, he saw, although the school seemed to be at ridiculous pains to hide the fact. Instead of a school card or a grade report, it was called a quarterly progress report. He grunted at that and opened the card. A typed half-sheet of paper fell out. Dusanda put it aside for later examination and turned his attention to the boy's grades first.
"You seem to have fallen on the rocks, my boy," Dusanda said, not without some pleasure. The boy had passed only English and American history. Every other grade was an F.
"It's not my fault," Todd hissed venomously. "It's your fault. All those stories. I have nightmares about them. Do you know that? I sit down and open my books and I start thinking about whatever you told me that day, and the next thing I know, my mother's telling me it's time to go to bed. Well, that's not my fault. It isn't. You hear me? It isn't."
"I hear you very well," Dusanda said, and read the typed note that had been tucked into Todd's card. Dear Mr. and Mrs. Bowden, this notice to suggest that we have a group conference concerning Todd's second and third quarter grades. In light of Todd's previous good work in this school, his current grades suggest a specific problem which may be affecting his academic performance in a deleterious way. Such a problem can often be solved by a frank and open discussion. I should point out that although Todd has passed the half year, his final grades may be failing in some cases, unless his work improves radically in the fourth quarter. Failing grades would entail summer school to avoid being kept back and causing a major scheduling problem. I must also note that Todd is in the college division and that his work so far this year is far below college acceptance levels. It is also below the level of academic ability assumed by the SAT tests. Please be assured that I am ready to work out a mutually convenient time for us to meet. In a case such as this, earlier is usually better. Sincerely yours, Edward French.
Who is this Edward French? Dusanda asked, slipping the note back inside the card. Part of him still marveled at the American love of jargon, such a rolling missive to inform the parents that their son was flunking out, and then refolding his hands. His premonition of disaster was stronger than ever, but he refused to give in to it. A year before he would have done. A year ago he had been ready for disaster. Now he was not, but it seemed that the cursed boy had brought it to him anyway. Is he your headmaster? Robber Ed? Hell no, he's the guidance counselor. Guidance counselor? What is that? You can figure it out, Todd said. He was nearly hysterical. You read the goddamn note.
He walked rapidly around the room, shooting sharp, quick glances at Dusander.
Well, I'm not going to let any of this shit go down. I'm just not. I'm not going to any summer school. My dad and Mom are going to Hawaii this summer, and I'm going with them.
He pointed at the card on the table.
Do you know what my dad will do if he sees that?
Dusander shook his head.
He'll get everything out of me. Everything. He'll know it was you. It couldn't be anything else, because nothing else has changed. He'll poke and pry, and he'll get it all out of me. And then I'll be in Dutch.
He stared at Dusander resentfully.
They'll watch me. Hell, he might make me see a doctor. I don't know. How should I know? But I'm not getting in Dutch, and I'm not going to any fucking summer school.
Or to the reformatory, Dusander said. He said it very quietly. Todd stopped circling the room. His face became very still. His cheeks and forehead, already pale, became even whiter. He stared at Dusander and had to try twice before he could speak.
What? What did you just say?
My dear boy, Dusander said, assuming an air of great patience, for the last 5 minutes I have listened to you pule and whine, and what all your puling and whining comes down to is this. You are in trouble. You might be found out. You might find yourself in adverse circumstances. Seeing that he had the boy's complete attention, at last, Dusander sipped reflectively from his cup. My boy, he went on, that is a very dangerous attitude for you to have. And dangerous for me. The potential harm is much greater for me. You worry about your school card. Pah! This for your school card, he flicked it off the table and onto the floor with one yellow finger. I am worried about my life. Todd did not reply. He simply went on looking at Dusander with that white-eyed, slightly crazed stare.
The Israelis will not scruple at the fact that I am 76. The death penalty is still very much in favor over there, you know, especially when the man in the dock is a Nazi war criminal associated with the camps. You're a U.S. citizen, Todd said. America wouldn't let them take you. I read up on that. You read, but you don't listen. I am not a U.S. citizen. My papers came from La Cosa Nostra. I would be deported. And Mossad agents would be waiting for me wherever I deplaned.
I wish they would hang you, Todd muttered, curling his hands into fists and staring down at them.
I was crazy to get mixed up with you in the first place.
No doubt, Dusander said and smiled thinly.
But you are mixed up with me. We must live in the present, boy, not in the past of I should have nevers. You must realize that your fate and my own are now inextricably entwined. If you blow the horn on me, as your saying goes, do you think I will hesitate to blow the horn on you? 700,000 died at Patin. To the world at large I am a criminal, a monster. Even the butcher, your scandal rags, would have me. You are an accessory to all of that, my boy. You have criminal knowledge of an illegal alien, but you have not reported it. And if I am caught, I will tell the world all about you. When the reporters put their microphones in my face, it will be your name I'll repeat over and over again. Todd Bowden. Yes, that is his name. How long? Almost a year. He wanted to know everything. All the gushy parts, that's how we put it, yes, all the gushy parts.
Todd's breath had stopped. His skin appeared transparent. Dusander smiled at him. He sipped bourbon.
I think they will put you in jail. They may call it a reformatory or a correctional facility. There may be a fancy name for it, like this quarterly progress report.
His lip curled.
But no matter what they call it, there will be bars on the windows.
Todd wet his lips.
I call you a liar. I tell them I just found out. They believe me, not you. You just better remember that.
Dusander's thin smile remained.
I thought you told me your father would get it all out of you.
Todd spoke slowly, as a person speaks when realization and verbalization occur simultaneously.
Maybe not.
Maybe not this time. This isn't just breaking a window with a rock.
Dusander winced inwardly. He suspected that the boy's judgment was right. With so much at stake, he might indeed be able to convince his father. After all, when faced with such an unpleasant truth, what parent would not want to be convinced?
Perhaps, perhaps not. But how are you going to explain all those books you had to read to me because poor Mr. Denker is half-blind? My eyes are not what they were, but I can still read fine print with my spectacles. I can prove it.
I'd say you fooled me.
Will you? And what reason will you be able to give for my fooling?
For friendship, because you were lonely.
That, Dusander reflected, was just close enough to the truth to be believable. And once, in the beginning, the boy might have been able to bring it off. But now he was ragged. Now he was coming apart in strings like a coat that has reached the end of its useful service. If a child shot off his cap pistol across the street, this boy would jump into the air and scream like a girl.
Your school card will also support my side of it, Dusander said.
It was not Robinson Crusoe that caused your grades to fall down so badly, my boy, was it?
Shut up, why don't you? Just shut up about it.
No, Dusander said. I won't shut up about it.
He lit a cigarette, scratching the wooden match alight on the gas oven door.
Not until I make you see the simple truth. We are in this together, sink or swim.
He looked at Todd through the raftering smoke, not smiling, his old, lined face reptilian.
I will drag you down, boy. I promise you that. If anything comes out, everything will come out. That is my promise to you.
Todd stared at him sullenly and didn't reply.
Now, Dusander said briskly, with the air of a man who has put a necessary unpleasantness behind him, the question is, what are we going to do about this situation? Have you any ideas?
This will fix the report card, Todd said, and took a new bottle of ink eradicator from his jacket pocket.
About that fucking letter, I don't know.
Dusander looked at the ink eradicator approvingly. He had falsified a few reports of his own in his time, when the quotas had gone up to the point of fantasy, and far, far beyond. And more like the situation they were now in, there had been the matter of the invoices, those which enumerated the spoils of war. Each week he would check the boxes of valuables, all of them to be sent back to Berlin in special train cars that were like big safes on wheels. On the side of each box was a manila envelope, and inside the envelope there had been a verified invoice of that box's contents.
So many rings, necklaces, chokers, so many grams of gold. Dusander, however, had had his own box of valuables. Not very valuable valuables, but not insignificant either. Jades, tourmalines, opals, a few flawed pearls, industrial diamonds. And when he saw an item invoiced for Berlin that caught his eye or seemed a good investment, he would remove it, replace it with an item from his own box, and use ink eradicator on the invoice, changing their item for his. He had developed into a fairly expert forger, a talent that had come in handy more than once after the war was over.
Good, he told Todd. As for this other matter...
Dusander began to rock again, sipping from his cup. Todd pulled a chair up to the table and began to go to work on his report card, which he had picked up from the floor without a word. Dusander's outward calm had had its effect on him, and now he worked silently, his head bent studiously over the card, like any American boy who has set out to do the best by God job he can, whether that job be planting corn, pitching a no-hitter in the Little League World Series, or forging grades on his report card. Dusander looked at the nape of his neck, lightly tanned and cleanly exposed between the fall of his hair and the round neck of his T-shirt. His eyes drifted from there to the top counter drawer where he kept the butcher knives. One quick thrust. He knew where to put it. And the boy's spinal cord would be severed. His lips would be sealed forever. Dusander smiled regretfully. There would be questions asked as the boy disappeared. Too many of them. Some directed at him. Even if there was no letter with a friend, close scrutiny was something he could not afford. Too bad. This man, French, he said, tapping the letter. Does he know your parents in a social way?
Him?
Todd edged the word with contempt. My mom and dad don't go anywhere that he could even get in.
Has he ever met them in his professional capacity? Has he ever had conferences with them before?
No, I've always been near the top of my classes until now.
So what does he know about them, Dusander said, looking dreamily into his cup, which was now nearly empty. Oh, he knows about you. He no doubt has all the records on you that he can use, back to the fights you had in the kindergarten play yard. But what does he know about them?
Todd put his pen and the small bottle of ink eradicator away.
Well, he knows their names, of course, and their ages. He knows we're all Methodists.
You don't have to fill that line out, but my folks always do.
We don't go much, but he'd know that's what we are. He must know what my dad does for a living. That's on the forms, too. All that stuff they have to fill out every year, and I'm pretty sure that's all.
Would he know if your parents were having troubles at home?
What's that supposed to mean?
Dusander tossed off the last of the bourbon in his cup.
Squabbles, fights, your father sleeping on the couch, your mother drinking too much.
His eyes gleamed. A divorce brewing.
Indignantly, Todd said, There's nothing like that going on. No way.
I never said there was. But just think, boy. Suppose that things at your house were going to hell in a streetcar, as the saying is.
Todd only looked at him, frowning.
You would be worried about them, Dusander said. Very worried. You would lose your appetite. You would sleep poorly. Saddest of all, your schoolwork would suffer. True? Very sad for the children when there are troubles in the home.
Understanding dawned in the boy's eyes. Understanding, and something like dumb gratitude. Dusander was gratified.
Yes, it is an unhappy situation when a family totters on the edge of destruction.
Dusander said grandly, pouring more bourbon. He was getting quite drunk.
The daytime television dramas, they make this absolutely clear. There is acrimony, backbiting, and lies. Most of all, there is pain. Pain, my boy. You have no idea of the hell your parents are going through. They are so swallowed up by their own troubles that they have little time for the problems of their own son. His problems seem minor compared to theirs, eh? Some day, when the scars have begun to heal, they will no doubt take a fuller interest in him once again. But now, the only concession they can make is to send the boy's kindly grandfather to Mr. French. Todd's eyes had been gradually brightening to a glow that was nearly fervid. Might work, he was muttering. Might, yeah, might work, might... He broke off suddenly. His eyes darkened again. No, it won't. You don't look like me, not even a little bit. Rubberhead'll never believe it. Himmel! Gott im Himmel! Dusander cried, getting to his feet, crossing the kitchen a bit unsteadily, opening the cellar door and pulling out a fresh bottle of ancient age. He spun off the cap and poured liberally. For a smart boy, you are such a Dummkopf. When do grandfathers ever look like their grandsons? Ah, I got white hair. Do you have white hair? Approaching the table again, he reached out with surprising quickness, snatched an abundant handful of Todd's blonde hair, and pulled briskly. Cut it out, Todd snapped. But he smiled a little. Besides, Dusander said, settling back into his rocker, you have yellow hair and blue eyes. My eyes are blue, and before my hair turned white, it was yellow. You can tell me your whole family history, your aunts and uncles, the people your father works with, your mother's little hobbies. I will remember. I will study and remember. 2 days later, it will all be forgotten again. These days, my memory is like a cloth bag filled with water, but I will remember for long enough. He smiled grimly. In my time, I have stayed ahead of Wiesenthal and pulled the wool over the eyes of Himmler himself. If I cannot fool one American public school teacher, I will pull my winding shroud around me and crawl down into my grave. Maybe, Todd said slowly. And Dusander could see he had already accepted it. His eyes were luminous with relief. No, surely, Dusander cried. He began to cackle with laughter, the rocking chair squeaking back and forth. Todd looked at him, puzzled and a little frightened, but after a bit he began to laugh too. In Dusander's kitchen they laughed and laughed. Dusander by the open window, where the warm California breeze wafted in, and Todd rocked back on the rear legs of his kitchen chair so that its back rested against the oven door, the white enamel of which was crisscrossed by the dark, charred-looking streaks made by Dusander's wooden matches as he struck them alight. Rubber Ed French, his nickname, Todd had explained to Dusander, referred to the rubbers he always wore over his sneakers during wet weather, was a slight man who made an affectation of always wearing Keds to school. It was a touch of informality which he thought would endear him to the 106 children between the ages of 12 and 14 who made up his counseling load. He had 5 pairs of Keds, ranging in color from fast-track blue to screaming yellow zonkers, totally unaware that behind his back he was known not only as Rubber Ed, but as Sneaker Pete and the Ked Man, as in the Ked Man Cometh. He had been known as Pucker in college, and he would have been most humiliated of all to learn that even that shameful fact had somehow gotten out. He rarely wore ties, preferring turtleneck sweaters. He had been wearing these ever since the mid-60s, when David McCallum had popularized them in The Man from U.N.C.L.E. In his college days, his classmates had been known to spy him crossing the quad and remark, "Here comes Pucker in his uncle's sweater." He had majored in educational psychology, and he privately considered himself to be the only good guidance counselor he had ever met. He had real rapport with his kids. He could get right down to it with them. He could rap with them and be silently sympathetic if they had to do some shouting and kick out the jams. He could get into their hang-ups because he understood what a bummer it was to be 13 when someone was doing a number on your head and you couldn't get your shit together. The thing was, he had a damned hard time remembering what it had been like to be 13 himself. He supposed that was the ultimate price you had to pay for growing up in the 50s. That and traveling into the brave new world of the 60s nicknamed Pucker. Now, as Todd Bowden's grandfather came into his office, closing the pebbled glass door firmly behind him, Rubber Ed stood up respectfully, but was careful not to come around his desk to greet the old man. He was aware of his sneakers. Sometimes the old-timers didn't understand that the sneakers were a psychological aid with kids who had teacher hang-ups.
which was to say that some of the older folks couldn't get behind a guidance counselor in Keds. "This is one fine-looking dude," Rubber Ed thought. His white hair was carefully brushed back, his three-piece suit was spotlessly clean, his dove-gray tie was impeccably knotted. In his left hand he held a furled black umbrella. Outside, a light drizzle had been falling since the weekend, in a manner that was almost military. A few years ago, Rubber Ed and his wife had gone on a Dorothy Sayers jag, reading everything by that estimable lady that they could lay their hands upon. It occurred to him now that this was her brainchild, Lord Peter Wimsey, to the life. It was Wimsey at 75, years after both Bunter and Harriet Vane had passed on to their rewards. He made a mental note to tell Sandra about this when he got home. "Mr. Bowden," he said respectfully and offered his hand. "A pleasure," Bowden said, and shook it. Rubber Ed was careful not to put on the firm and uncompromising pressure he applied to the hands of the fathers he saw. It was obvious from the gingerly way the old boy offered it that he had arthritis. "A pleasure, Mr. French," Bowden repeated, and took a seat, carefully pulling up the knees of his trousers. He propped the umbrella between his feet and leaned on it, looking like an elderly, extremely urbane vulture that had come in to roost in Rubber Ed French's office. He had the slightest touch of an accent, Rubber Ed thought, but it wasn't the clipped intonation of the British upper class, as Wimsey's would have been. It was broader, more European. Anyway, the resemblance to Todd was quite striking, especially through the nose and the eyes. "I'm glad you could come," Rubber Ed told him, resuming his own seat. Although in these cases the student's mother or father... This was the opening gambit, of course. Almost 10 years of experience in the counseling business had convinced him that when an aunt or an uncle or a grandparent showed up for a conference, it usually meant trouble at home. The sort of trouble that invariably turned out to be the root of the problem. To Rubber Ed, this came as a relief. Domestic problems were bad, but for a boy of Todd's intelligence, a heavy drug trip would have been much, much worse. "Yes, of course," Bowden said, managing to look both sorrowful and angry at the same time. "My son and his wife asked me if I could come and talk this sorry business over with you, Mr. French. Todd is a good boy, believe me. This trouble with his school marks is only temporary." "Well, we all hope so, don't we, Mr. Bowden? Smoke if you like. It's supposed to be off-limits on school property, but I'll never tell." "Thank you." Mr. Bowden took a half-crushed package of Camel cigarettes from his inner pocket, put one of the last two zigzagging smokes in his mouth, found a diamond blue-tip match, scratched it on the heel of one black shoe, and lit up. He coughed an old man's dank cough over the first drag, shook the match out, and put the blackened stump into the ashtray Rubber Ed had produced. Rubber Ed watched this ritual, which seemed almost as formal as the old man's shoes, with frank fascination. "Where to begin?" Bowden said, his distressed face looking at Rubber Ed through a swirling raft of cigarette smoke. "Well," Rubber Ed said kindly, "the very fact that you're here instead of Todd's parents tells me something, you know."
"Yes, I suppose it does." "Very well." He folded his hands. The Camel protruded from between the second and third fingers of his right. He straightened his back and lifted his chin. There was something almost Prussian in his mental coming to terms, Rubber Ed thought. Something that made him think of all those war movies he'd seen as a kid. "My son and daughter-in-law are having troubles in their home," Bowden said, biting off each word precisely. "Rather bad troubles, I should think." His eyes, old but amazingly bright, watched as Rubber Ed opened the folder centered in front of him on the desk blotter. There were sheets of paper inside, but not many. "And you feel that these troubles are affecting Todd's academic performance?" Bowden leaned forward, perhaps 6 inches. His blue eyes never left Rubber Ed's brown ones. There was a heavily charged pause, and then Bowden said, "The mother drinks." He resumed his former ramrod straight position.
"Oh," Rubber Ed said.
"Yes," Bowden replied, nodding grimly. "The boy has told me that he has come home on 2 occasions and has found her sprawled out on the kitchen table.
He knows how my son feels about her drinking problem, and so the boy has put dinner in the oven himself on these occasions, and has gotten her to drink enough black coffee so she will at least be awake when Richard comes home.
That's bad, Rubber Ed said, although we had heard worse. Mothers with heroin habits, fathers who had abruptly taken it into their heads to start banging their daughters or their sons.
Has Mrs. Bowden thought about getting professional help for her problem?
The boy has tried to persuade her that that would be the best course. She is much ashamed, I think. If she was given a little time...
He made a gesture with his cigarette that left a dissolving smoke ring in the air.
You understand?
Yes, of course. Rubber Ed nodded, privately admiring the gesture that had produced the smoke ring.
Your son, Todd's father...
He is not without blame, Bowden said harshly. The hours he works, the meals he has missed, the nights when he must leave suddenly, I tell you, Mr. French, he is more married to his job than he is to Monica. I was raised to believe that a man's family came before everything. Was it not the same for you?
It sure was, Rubber Ed responded heartily. His father had been a night watchman for a large Los Angeles department store, and he had really only seen his pop on weekends and vacations.
That is another side of the problem, Bowden said.
Rubber Ed nodded and thought for a moment. What about your other son, Mr. Bowden? He looked down at the folder.
Harold, Todd's uncle.
Harry and Deborah are in Minnesota now, Bowden said quite truthfully. He has a position there at the university medical school. It would be quite difficult for him to leave, and very unfair to ask him. His face took on a righteous cast. Harry and his wife are quite happily married.
I see.
Rubber Ed looked at the file again for a moment and then closed it. Mr. Bowden, I appreciate your frankness. I'll be just as frank with you.
Thank you, Bowden said stiffly.
We can't do as much for our students in the counseling area as we would like. There are 6 counselors here, and we're each carrying a load of over 100 students. My newest colleague, Hepburn, has 115. At this age in our society, all children need help.
Of course.
Bowden mashed his cigarette brutally into the ashtray and folded his hands once more. Sometimes bad problems get by us. Home, environment, and drugs are the 2 most common. At least Todd isn't mixed up with speed or mescaline or PCP.
God forbid.
Sometimes, Rubber Ed went on, there's simply nothing we can do. It's depressing, but it's a fact of life. Usually the ones that are first to get spit out of the machine we're running here are the class troublemakers, the sullen, uncommunicative kids, the ones who refuse to even try. They are simply warm bodies waiting for the system to buck them up through the grades, or waiting to get old enough so they can quit without their parents' permission and join the army, or get a job at the speedy boy car wash, or marry their boyfriends. You understand? I'm being blunt. Our system is, as they say, not all it's cracked up to be.
I appreciate your frankness.
But it hurts when you see the machine starting to mash up someone like Todd. He ran out a 92 average for last year's work, and that puts him in the 95th percentile. His English averages are even better. He shows a flair for writing, and that's something special in a generation of kids that think culture begins in front of the TV and ends in the neighborhood movie theater. I was talking to the woman who had Todd in comp last year. She said Todd passed in the finest term paper she'd seen in 20 years of teaching. It was on the German death camps during World War II. She gave him the only A+ she's ever given a composition student.
I have read it, Bowden said. It is very fine.
He has also demonstrated above-average ability in the life sciences and social sciences. And while he's not going to be one of the great math whizzes of the century, all the notes I have indicate that he's given it the good old college try. Until this year.
Until this year. That's the whole story, in a nutshell.
Yes.
I'd hate like hell to see Todd go down the tubes this way, Mr. Bowden. And summer school... Well, I said I'd be frank. Summer school often does a boy like Todd more harm than good. Your usual junior high school summer session is a zoo. All the monkeys and the laughing hyenas are in attendance, plus a full complement of dodo birds. Bad company for a boy like Todd.
Certainly.
So, let's get to the bottom line, shall we? I suggest a series of appointments for Mr. and Mrs. Bowden at the counseling center downtown.
Everything in confidence, of course. The man in charge down there, Harry Ackerman, is a good friend of mine, and I don't think Todd should go to them with the idea. I think you should. Rubber Ed smiled widely. Maybe we can get everybody back on track by June. It's not impossible. But Bowden looked positively alarmed by this idea. I believe they might resent the boy if I took that proposal to them now, he said. Things are very delicate. They could go either way. The boy has promised me he will work harder in his studies. He is very alarmed at the drop in his marks. He smiled thinly, a smile Ed French could not quite interpret. More alarmed than you know. But, and they would resent me, Bowden pressed on quickly. God knows they would. Monica already regards me as something of a meddler. I try not to be, but you see the situation. I feel that things are best left alone for now. I've had a great deal of experience in these matters, Rubber Ed told Bowden. He folded his hands on Todd's file and looked at the old man earnestly. I really think counseling is in order here. You'll understand that my interest in the marital problems your son and daughter-in-law are having begins and ends with the effect they're having on Todd. And right now they're having quite an effect.
Let me make a counter-proposal, Bowden said. You have, I believe, a system of warning parents of poor grades.
Yes, Rubber Ed agreed cautiously. Interpretation of progress cards, IOP cards. The kids, of course, call them flunk cards. They only get them if their grade in a given course falls below 78. In other words, we give out IOP cards to kids who are pulling a D or an F in a given course.
Very good, Bowden said. Then what I suggest is this. If the boy gets one of those cards, even one, he held up one gnarled finger, I will approach my son and his wife about your counseling. I will go further. If the boy receives one of your flunk cards in April, we give them out in May, actually. Yes, if he receives one then, I guarantee that they will accept the counseling proposal. They are worried about their son, Mr. French, but now they are so wrapped up in their own problem that...
He shrugged. I understand.
So let us give them that long to solve their own problems. Pulling oneself up by one's own shoelaces, that is the American way, is it not?
Yes, I guess it is, Rubber Ed told him after a moment's thought, and after a quick glance at the clock which told him he had another appointment in 5 minutes. I'll accept that. He stood, and Bowden stood with him. They shook hands again, Rubber Ed being carefully mindful of the old party's arthritis. But in all fairness, I ought to tell you that very few students can pull out of an 18-week tailspin in just 4 weeks of classes. There's a huge amount of ground to be made up, a huge amount. I suspect you'll have to come through on your guarantee, Mr. Bowden.
Bowden offered his thin, disconcerting smile again. Do you? Was all he said.
Something had troubled Rubber Ed through the entire interview, and he put his finger on it during lunch in the cafeteria, more than an hour after Lord Peter had left, umbrella once again neatly tucked under his arm. He and Todd's grandfather had talked for 15 minutes at least, probably closer to 20, and Ed didn't think the old man had once referred to his grandson by name. Todd pedaled breathlessly up Dusander's Walk and parked his bike on its kickstand. School had let out only 15 minutes before. He took the front steps at one jump, used his door key, and hurried down the hall to the sunlit kitchen. His face was a mixture of hopeful sunshine and gloomy clouds. He stood in the kitchen doorway for a moment, his stomach and his vocal cords knotted, watching Dusander as he rocked with his cupful of bourbon in his lap. He was still dressed in his best, although he had pulled his tie down 2 inches and loosened the top button of his shirt. He looked at Todd expressionlessly, his lizard-like eyes at half-mast.
Well? Todd finally managed.
Dusander left him hanging a moment longer, a moment that seemed at least 10 years long to Todd. Then, deliberately, Dusander set his cup on the table next to his bottle of ancient age and said,
The fool believed everything.
Todd let out his pent-up breath in a whooping gust of relief. Before he could draw another breath in, Dusander added,
He wanted your poor, troubled parents to attend counseling sessions downtown with a friend of his. He was really quite insistent.
Jesus! Did you...
What did you... How did you handle it?
I thought quickly, Dusander replied. Like the little girl in the Saki story, invention on short notice is one of my strong points. I promised him your parents would go in for such counseling if you received even one flunk card when they are given in May. The blood fell out of Todd's face.
You did what?
He nearly screamed. I've already flunked two algebra quizzes and a history test since the marking period started. He advanced into the room, his pale face now growing shiny with breaking sweat.
There was a French quiz this afternoon, and I flunked that too. I know I did. All I could think about was that goddamn rubber Ed and whether or not you were taking care of him.
You took care of him, all right, he finished bitterly.
Not get one flunk card, I'll probably get five or six.
It was the best I could do without arousing suspicions, Dusander said. This French fool that he is only doing his job. Now you will do yours.
What's that supposed to mean?
Todd's face was ugly and thunderous, his voice truculent. You will work. In the next 4 weeks, you will work harder than you have ever worked in your life. Furthermore, on Monday, you will go to each of your instructors and apologize them for your poor showing thus far. You will...
It's impossible, Todd said. You don't get it, man. It's impossible. I'm at least 5 weeks behind in science and history. In algebra, it's more like 10.
Nevertheless, Dusander said. He poured more bourbon.
You think you're pretty smart, don't you? Todd shouted at him.
Well, I don't take orders from you. The days when you gave orders are long over. Do you get it?
He lowered his voice abruptly. The most lethal thing you've got around the house these days is a shell no-pest strip. You're nothing but a broken-down old man who farts rotten eggs if he eats a taco. I bet you even pee in your bed.
Listen to me, snot-nose, Dusander said quietly. Todd's head jerked angrily around at that. Before today, Dusander said carefully, it was possible, just barely possible, that you could have denounced me and come out clean yourself. I don't believe you would have been up to the job with your nerves in their present state, but never mind that. It would have been technically possible. But now things have changed. Today I impersonated your grandfather, one Victor Bowden. No one can have the slightest doubt that I did it with, how is the word, your connivance. If it comes out now, boy, you will look blacker than ever, and you will have no defense. I took care of that today.
You wish, Dusander roared. Never mind your wishes. Your wishes make me sick. Your wishes are no more than little piles of dog shit in the gutter. All I want from you is to know if you understand the situation we are in.
I understand it, Todd muttered. His fists had been tightly clenched while Dusander shouted at him. He was not used to being shouted at. Now he opened his hands and dully observed that he had dug bleeding half-moons into his palms. The cuts would have been worse, he supposed, but in the last 4 months or so he had taken up biting his nails.
Good. And you will make your sweet apologies, and you will study. In your free time at school, you will study. During your lunch hours, you will study. After school, you will come here and study, and on your weekends, you will come here and do more of the same.
Not here, Todd said quickly. At home.
No. At home you will dawdle and daydream as you have all along. If you are here, I can stand over you if I have to and watch you. I can protect my own interests in this matter. I can quiz you. I can listen to your lessons. If I don't want to come here, you can't make me.
Dusander drank.
That is true. Things will then go on as they have. You will fail. This guidance person, French, will expect me to make good on my promise. When I don't, he will call your parents. They will find out that kindly Mr. Denker impersonated your grandfather at your request. They will find out about the altered grades. Oh, shut up, I'll come.
You're already here. Begin with algebra.
No way, it's Friday afternoon. You study every afternoon now,
Dusander said softly. Begin with algebra. Todd stared at him. Only for a moment,
before dropping his eyes and fumbling his algebra text out of his book bag. And Dusander saw murder in the boy's eyes. Not figurative murder, literal murder. It had been years since he had seen that dark, burning, speculative glance, but one never forgot it. He supposed he would have seen it in his own eyes if there had been a mirror at hand on the day he had looked at the white and defenseless nape of the boy's neck.
"I must protect myself," he thought with some amazement. "One underestimates at one's own risk." He drank his bourbon and rocked and watched the boy study.
It was nearly 5 o'clock when Todd biked home. He felt washed out, hot-eyed, drained, impotently angry. Every time his eyes had wandered from the printed page, from the maddening, incomprehensible, fucking stupid world of sets, subsets, ordered pairs, and Cartesian coordinates, Dusander's sharp old man's voice had spoken. Otherwise, he had remained completely silent, except for the maddening bump of his slippers on the floor and the squeak of the rocker. He sat there like a vulture waiting for its prey to expire. Why had he ever gotten into this? How had he gotten into it? This was a mess, a terrible mess. He had picked up some ground this afternoon, some of the set theory that had stumped him so badly just before the Christmas break had fallen into place with an almost audible click. But it was impossible to think he could pick up enough to scrape through next week's algebra test with even a D. It was 4 weeks until the end of the world. On the corner, he saw a blue jay lying on the sidewalk, its beak slowly opening and closing. It was trying vainly to get onto its birdy feet and hop away. One of its wings had been crushed, and Todd supposed a passing car had hit it and flipped it up onto the sidewalk like a tiddlywink. One of its beady eyes stared up at him. Todd looked at it for a long time, holding the grips of his bike's ape-hanger handlebars lightly. Some of the warmth had gone out of the day, and the air felt almost chilly. He supposed his friends had spent the afternoon goofing off down at the Babe Ruth Diamond on Walnut Street, maybe playing a little scrub, more likely playing pepper or three-fly six-grounders or roly-bat. It was the time of the year when you started working your way up to baseball. There was some talk about getting up their own sandlot team this year to compete in the informal city league. There were dads enough willing to schlep them around to games. Todd, of course, would pitch. He had been a little league pitching star until he had grown out of the senior little league division last year. Would have pitched. So what? He'd just have to tell them no. He'd just have to tell them, guys, I got mixed up with this war criminal. I got him right by the balls, and then, this'll kill you guys. Then I found out he was holding my balls as tight as I was holding his. I started having funny dreams and the cold sweats. My grades went to hell, and I changed them on my report card so my folks wouldn't find out. And now I've got to hit the books really hard for the first time in my life. I'm not afraid of getting grounded, though. I'm afraid of going to the reformatory. And that's why I can't play any sandlot with you guys this year. You see how it is, guys. A thin smile, much like Dusander's, and not at all like his former broad grin, touched his lips. There was no sunshine in it. It was a shady smile. There was no fun in it. No confidence. It merely said, "You see how it is, guys." He rolled his bike forward over the jay with exquisite slowness, hearing the newspaper crackle of its feathers and the crunch of its small hollow bones as they fractured inside it. He reversed, rolling over it again. It was still twitching. He rolled over it again. A single bloody feather stuck to his front tire, revolving up and down, up and down. By then the bird had stopped moving. The bird had kicked the bucket. The bird had punched out. The bird had gone to that great aviary in the sky. But Todd kept going forwards and backwards across its mashed body just the same. He did it for almost 5 minutes, and that thin smile never left his face. You see how it is, guys. 10.
April 1975. The old man stood halfway down the compound's aisle, smiling broadly, as Dave Klingerman walked up to meet him. The frenzied barking that filled the air didn't seem to bother him in the slightest, or the smells of fur and urine, or the 100 different strays yapping and howling in their cages, dashing back and forth, leaping against the mesh. Klingerman pegged the old guy as a dog lover right off the bat. His smile was sweet and pleasant. He offered Dave a swollen, arthritis-bunched hand carefully, and Klingerman shook it in the same spirit. "Hello, sir," he said, speaking up. "Noisy as hell, isn't it?"
"I don't mind," the old man said. "Not at all. My name is Arthur Denker."
"Klingerman, Dave Klingerman."
"I am pleased to meet you, sir. I read in the paper, I could not believe it, that you give dogs away here. Perhaps I misunderstood. In fact, I think I must have misunderstood."
"No, we give 'em away all right," Dave said. "If we can't, we have to destroy 'em. 60 days, that's what the state gives us. Shame. Come on in the office here, quieter. Smells better, too."
In the office, Dave heard a story that was familiar, but nonetheless affecting. Arthur Denker was in his 70s. He had come to California when his wife died. He was not rich, but he tended what he did have with great care. He was lonely. His only friend was the boy who sometimes came to his house and read to him. In Germany, he had owned a beautiful St. Bernard. Now, in Santo Donato, he had a house with a good-sized backyard. The yard was fenced, and, he had read in the paper, would it be possible that he could...
"Well, we don't have any Bernards," Dave said. "They go fast because they're so good with kids."
"Oh, I understand. I didn't mean that.
But I do have a half-grown shepherd pup. How would that be?"
Mr. Denker's eyes grew bright, as if he might be on the verge of tears.
"Perfect," he said. "That would be perfect.
The dog itself is free, but there are a few other charges, distemper and rabies shots, a city dog license. All of it goes about $25 for most people, but the state pays half if you're over 65, part of the California Golden Ager program."
"Golden Ager. Is that what I am?" Mr. Denker said, and laughed.
For just a moment, it was silly. Dave felt a kind of chill.
I guess so, sir." "It is very reasonable."
"Sure, we think so. The same dog would cost you $125 in a pet shop. But people go to those places instead of here. They're paying for a set of papers, of course, not the dog." Dave shook his head. "If they only understood how many fine animals are abandoned every year."
"And if you can't find a suitable home for them within 60 days, they are destroyed?"
"We put them to sleep, yes."
"Put them to... I'm sorry, my English."
"It's a city ordinance," Dave said. "Can't have dog packs running the streets."
"You shoot them?"
"No, we give them gas. It's very humane. They don't feel a thing."
"No," Mr. Denker said. "I am sure they don't."
Todd's seat in beginning algebra was 4 desks down in the 2nd row. He sat there trying to keep his face expressionless as Mr. Storman passed back the exams. But his ragged fingernails were digging into his palms again, and his entire body seemed to be running with a slow and caustic sweat.
"Don't get your hopes up. Don't be such a goddamn chump. There's no way you could have passed. You know you didn't pass."
Nevertheless, he could not completely squash the foolish hope. It had been the first algebra exam in weeks that looked as if it had been written in something other than Greek. He was sure that in his nervousness...
Nervousness, no. Call it what it really had been, outright terror. He had not done that well. But maybe...
Well, if it had been anyone else but Storman, who had a Yale padlock for a heart...
"Stop it!"
he commanded himself. And for a moment, a coldly horrible moment, he was positive he had screamed those 2 words aloud in the classroom.
"You flunked. You know you did. Not a thing in the world is going to change it."
Storman handed him his paper expressionlessly and moved on. Todd laid it face down on his initial scarred desk. For a moment, he didn't think he possessed sufficient will to even turn it over and know. At last he flipped it with such convulsive suddenness that the exam sheet tore. His tongue stuck to the roof of his mouth as he stared at it. His heart seemed to stop for a moment. The number 83
was written in a circle at the top of the sheet. Below it was a letter grade, C+. Below the letter grade was a brief notation. Good improvement. I think I'm twice as relieved as you should be. Check errors carefully. At least three of them are arithmetical rather than conceptual. His heartbeat began again, at triple time. Relief washed over him, but it was not cool. It was hot and complicated and strange. He closed his eyes, not hearing the class as it buzzed over the exam, and began the preordained fight for an extra point here or there. Todd saw redness behind his eyes. It pulsed like flowing blood with the rhythm of his heartbeat. In that instant he hated Dusander more than he ever had before. His hands snapped shut into fists, and he only wished, wished, wished that Dusander's scrawny chicken neck could have been between them. Dick and Monica Bowden had twin beds, separated by a nightstand with a pretty imitation Tiffany lamp standing on it. Their room was done in genuine redwood, and the walls were comfortably lined with books. Across the room, nestled between two ivory bookends, bull elephants on their hind legs, was a round Sony TV. Dick was watching Johnny Carson with the earplug in, while Monica read the new Michael Crichton that had come from the book club that day. "Dick," she put a bookmark, "This is where I fell asleep," it said, into the Crichton and closed it. On the TV, Buddy Hackett had just broken everyone up. Dick smiled. "Dick," she said more loudly. He pulled the earplug out. "What?" "Do you think Todd's all right?" He looked at her for a moment, frowning, then shook his head a little. "Je ne comprends pas, chérie." His limping French was a joke between them. His father had sent him an extra $200 to hire a tutor when he was flunking French. He had gotten Monica Darrow, picking her name at random from the cards tacked up on the Union bulletin board. By Christmas, she had been wearing his pin, and he had managed a C in French. "Well, he's lost weight." "Ah, he looks a little scrawny, sure," Dick said. He put the TV earplug in his lap where it emitted tiny, squawking sounds. "He's growing up, Monica." "So soon?" she asked uneasily. He laughed. "So soon. I shot up 7 inches as a teenager, from a 5'6" shrimp at 12 to the beautiful 6'1" mass of muscle you see before you today. My mother said that when I was 14 you could hear me growing in the night." "Good thing not all of you grew that much." "It's all in how you use it. Want to use it tonight?" "The wench grows bold," Dick Bowden said, and threw the earplug across the room. After, as he was drifting off to sleep, "Dick, he's having bad dreams, too." "Nightmares?" he muttered. "Nightmares. I've heard him moaning in his sleep 2 or 3 times when I've gone down to use the bathroom in the night. I didn't want to wake him up. It's silly, but my grandmother used to say you could drive a person insane if you woke them up in the middle of a bad dream." "She was the Pollock, wasn't she?" "The Pollock, yeah, the Pollock. Nice talk. You know what I mean. Why don't you just use the upstairs, John?" He had put it in himself 2 years ago. "You know the flush always wakes you up," she said. "So don't flush it." "Dick, that's nasty," he sighed. "Sometimes when I go in, he's sweating, and the sheets are damp." He grinned in the dark. "I bet." "What's that?" "Oh," she slapped him lightly. "That's nasty, too. Besides, he's only 13. 14 next month. He's not too young. A little precocious, maybe, but not too young." "How old were you?" 14 or 15. I don't remember exactly. But I remember I woke up thinking I'd died and gone to heaven." "But you were older than Todd is now." "All that stuff's happening younger. It must be the milk. Or the fluoride. Do you know they have sanitary napkin dispensers in all the girls' rooms of the school we built in Jackson Park last year? And that's a grammar school. Now your average 6th grader is only 11. How old were you when you started?" "I don't remember," she said. "All I know is Todd's dreams don't sound like he died and went to heaven." "Have you asked him about them?" "Once, about 6 weeks ago. You were off playing golf with that horrible Ernie Jacobs." "That horrible Ernie Jacobs is going to make me a full partner by 1977, if he doesn't screw himself to death with that high yellow secretary of his before then. Besides, he always pays the greens fees. What did Todd say?"
that he didn't remember, but a sort of shadow crossed his face. I think he did remember. Monica, I don't remember everything from my dear dead youth, but one thing I do remember is that wet dreams are not always pleasant. In fact, they can be downright unpleasant.
How can that be?
Guilt. All kinds of guilt. Some of it may be all the way from babyhood, when it was made very clear to him that wetting the bed was wrong. Then there's the sex thing. Who knows what brings a wet dream on? Copping a feel on the bus, looking up a girl's skirt in study hall, I don't know. The only one I can really remember was going off the high board at the YMCA pool on co-ed day and losing my trunks when I hit the water.
You got off on that? She asked, giggling a little.
Yeah. So if the kid doesn't want to talk to you about his John Thomas problems, don't force him.
We did our damn best to raise him without all those needless guilts.
You can't escape them. He brings them home from school like the coals he used to pick up in the first grade, from his friends or the ways teachers mince around certain subjects. He probably got it from my dad, too. Don't touch it in the night, Todd, or your hands will grow hair and you'll go blind and you'll start to lose your memory, and after a while your thing will turn black and rot off. So be careful, Todd.
Dick Bowden, your dad would never...
He wouldn't? Hell, he did. Just like your Polack grandmother told you that waking somebody up in the middle of a nightmare might drive him nuts. He also told me to always wipe off the ring of a public toilet before I sat on it so I wouldn't get other people's germs. I guess that was his way of saying syphilis. I bet your grandmother laid that one on you, too.
No, my mother, she said absently. And she told me to always flush, which is why I go downstairs.
It still wakes me up, Dick mumbled.
What?
Nothing.
This time he had actually drifted halfway over the threshold of sleep when she spoke his name again.
What?
He asked a little impatiently. You don't suppose...
Oh, never mind. Go back to sleep.
No, go on. Finish. I'm awake again.
I don't suppose what?
That old man, Mr. Denker. You don't think Todd's seeing too much of him, do you? Maybe he's... I don't know, maybe filling Todd up with a lot of stories.
The real heavy horrors, Dick said. The day the Essen Motorworks dropped below quota, he snickered.
It was just an idea, she said a little stiffly. The covers rustled as she turned over on her side. Sorry I bothered you.
He put a hand on her bare shoulder. I'll tell you something, babe, he said, and stopped for a moment, thinking carefully, choosing his words. I've been worried about Todd, too, sometimes.
Not the same things you've been worried about, but worried is worried, right?
She turned back to him.
About what?
Well, I grew up a lot different than he's growing up. My dad had the store. Vic the Grocer, everyone called him. He had a book where he kept the names of the people who owed him and how much they owed. You know what he called it?
No.
Dick rarely talked about his boyhood. She had always thought it was because he hadn't enjoyed it. She listened carefully now. He called it the left-hand book. He said the right hand was business, but the right hand should never know what the left hand was doing. He said if the right hand did know, it would probably grab a meat cleaver and chop the left hand right off.
You never told me that.
Well, I didn't like the old man very much when we first got married, and the truth is I still spend a lot of time not liking him. I couldn't understand why I had to wear pants from the Goodwill box while Mrs. Mazursky could get a ham on credit with that same old story about how her husband was going back to work next week. The only work that fucking wino Bill Mazursky ever had was holding onto a 12-cent bottle of muskie so it wouldn't fly away. All I ever wanted in those days was to get out of the neighborhood and away from my old man's life. So I made grades and played sports I didn't really like, and got a scholarship at UCLA. And I made damn sure I stayed in the top 10% of my classes because the only left-hand book the colleges kept in those days was for the GIs that fought the war. My dad sent me money for my textbooks, but the only other money I ever took from him was the time I wrote home in a panic because I was flunking funny book French. I met you. And I found out later from Mr. Halleck down the block that my dad put a lien on his car to scare up that $200. And now I've got you, and we've got Todd. I've always thought he was a damned fine boy, and I've tried to make sure he's always had everything he ever needed, anything that would help him grow into a fine man. I used to laugh at that old wheeze about a man wanting his son to be better than he was, but as I get older it seems less funny and more true. I never want Todd to have to wear pants from a Goodwill box because some wino's wife got a ham on credit. You understand?
Yes, of course I do, she said quietly.
Then, about 10 years ago, just before my old man finally got tired of fighting off the urban renewal guys and retired, he had a minor stroke. He was in the hospital for 10 days, and the people from the neighborhood, the Guineas and the Krauts, even some of the Jigs that started to move in around 1955 or so, they paid his bill. Every fucking cent. I couldn't believe it. They kept the store open, too. Fiona Castellano got 4 or 5 of her friends who were out of work to come in on shifts. When my old man got back, the books balanced out to the cent.
Wow, she said very softly.
You know what he said to me, my old man? That he'd always been afraid of getting old, of being scared and hurting and all by himself, of having to go into the hospital and not being able to make ends meet anymore, of dying. He said that after the stroke he wasn't scared anymore. He said he thought he could die well.
You mean die happy, Pap? I asked him.
No, he said. I don't think anyone dies happy, Dickie. He always called me Dickie. Still does. And that's another thing I guess I'll never be able to like. He said he didn't think anyone died happy, but you could die well. That impressed me. He was silent for a long, thoughtful time. The last 5 or 6 years, I've been able to get some perspective on my old man. Maybe because he's down there in San Remo and out of my hair. I started thinking that maybe the left-hand book wasn't such a bad idea. That was when I started to worry about Todd. I kept wanting to tell him about how there was maybe something more to life than me being able to take all of you to Hawaii for a month, or being able to buy Todd pants that don't smell like the mothballs they used to put in the Goodwill box. I could never figure out how to tell him those things. But I think maybe he knows. And it takes a load off my mind.
Reading to Mr. Denker, you mean?
Yes. He's not getting anything for that. Denker can't pay him. But here's this old guy, thousands of miles from any friends or relatives who might still be living. Here's this guy that's everything my father was afraid of. And there's Todd.
I never thought of it just like that.
Have you noticed the way Todd gets when you talk to him about that old man?
He gets very quiet.
Sure. He gets tongue-tied and embarrassed, like he was doing something nasty. Just like my pop used to when someone tried to thank him for laying some credit on them. We're Todd's right hand, that's all. You and me and all the rest. The house, the ski trips to Tahoe, the Thunderbird in the garage, his color TV. All his right hand. And he doesn't want us to see what his left hand is up to.
You don't think he's seeing too much of Denker, then?
Honey, look at his grades. If they were falling off, I'd be the first one to say, hey, enough is enough already. Don't go overboard. His grades are the first place trouble would show up, and how have they been?
As good as ever after that first slip.
So, what are we talking about? Listen, I've got a conference at 9, babe. If I don't get some sleep, I'm going to be sloppy.
Sure, go to sleep, she said indulgently.
And as he turned over, she kissed him lightly on one shoulder blade.
I love you.
Love you too, he said comfortably, and closed his eyes.
Everything's fine, Monica. You worry too much.
I know I do.
Good night.
They slept. Stop looking out the window, Dusander said. There is nothing out there to interest you.
Todd looked at him sullenly.
His history text was open on the table, showing a color plate of Teddy Roosevelt cresting San Juan Hill. Helpless Cubans were falling away from the hooves of Teddy's horse. Teddy was grinning a wide American grin, the grin of a man who knew that God was in his heaven and everything was bully. Todd Bowden was not grinning.
You like being a slave driver, don't you? He asked.
I like being a free man, Dusander said. Study. Suck my cock. As a boy, Dusander said, I would have had my mouth washed out with lye soap for saying such a thing.
Times change.
Do they? Dusander sipped his bourbon. Study.
Todd stared at Dusander. You're nothing but a goddamn rummy, you know that?
Study! Shut up!
Todd slammed his book shut. It made a rifle crack sound in Dusander's kitchen. I can never catch up anyway. Not in time for the test. There's 50 pages of this shit left, all the way up to World War I. I'll make a crib in Study Hall 2 tomorrow.
Harshly, Dusander said, You will do no such thing.
Why not? Who's going to stop me? You?
Boy, you are still having a hard time comprehending the stakes we play for. Do you think I enjoy keeping your sniveling brat nose in your books?
His voice rose, whipsawing, demanding, commanding.
Do you think I enjoy listening to your tantrums, your kindergarten swears? Suck my cock,
Dusander mimicked savagely in a high falsetto voice that made Todd flush darkly.
Suck my cock, so what? Who cares? I'll do it tomorrow. Suck my cock. Well, you like it,
Todd shouted back.
Yeah, you like it. The only time you don't feel like a zombie is when you're on my back. So give me a fucking break.
If you are caught with one of these cribbing papers, what do you think will happen? Who will be told first? Todd looked at his hands with their ragged, bitten fingernails and said nothing.
Who? Jesus, you know. Rubberhead.
Then my folks, I guess. Dusander nodded.
Me, I guess that too. Study. Put your cribbing paper in your head, where it belongs.
I hate you. Todd said dully. I really do. But he opened up his book again, and Teddy Roosevelt grinned up at him, Teddy galloping into the 20th century with his saber in his hand, Cubans falling back in disarray before him, possibly before the force of his fierce American grin. Dusander began to rock again. He held his teacup of bourbon in his hands. That's a good boy, he said, almost tenderly. Todd had his first wet dream on the last night of April, and he awoke to the sound of rain whispering secretly through the leaves and branches of the tree outside his window. In the dream, he had been in one of the Patton laboratories. He was standing at the end of a long, low table. A lush young girl of amazing beauty had been secured to this table with clamps. Dusander was assisting him. Dusander wore a white butcher's apron and nothing else. When he pivoted to turn on the monitoring equipment, Todd could see Dusander's scrawny buttocks grinding at each other like misshapen white stones. He handed something to Todd, something he recognized immediately, although he had never actually seen one. It was a dildo. The tip of it was polished metal, winking in the light of the overhead fluorescence like heartless chrome. The dildo was hollow. Snaking out of it was a black electrical cord that ended in a red rubber bulb.
Go ahead, Dusander said. The Fuhrer says it's all right. He says it's your reward for studying.
Todd looked down at himself and saw that he was naked. His small penis was fully erect, jutting plumply up at an angle from the thin peach down of his pubic hair. He slipped the dildo on. The fit was tight, but there was some sort of lubricant in there. The friction was pleasant. No, it was more than pleasant. It was delightful. He looked down at the girl and felt a strange shift in his thoughts, as if they had slipped into a perfect groove. Suddenly all things seemed right. Doors had been opened. He would go through them. He took the red rubber bulb in his left hand, put his knees on the table, and paused for just a moment, gauging the angle while his Norseman's prick made its own angle up and out from his slight boy's body. Dimly, far off, he could hear Dusander reciting,
Test run 84. Electricity, sexual stimulus, metabolism. Based on the Thyssen theories of negative reinforcement, subject is a young Jewish girl, approximately 16 years of age. No scars, no identifying marks, no known disabilities.
She cried out when the tip of the dildo touched her. Todd found the cry pleasant, as he did her fruitless struggles to free herself, or lacking that, to at least bring her legs together.
This is what they can't show in those magazines about the war, he thought, but it's there just the same.
He thrust forward suddenly, parting her with no grace. She shrieked like a fire bell. After her initial thrashings and efforts to expel him, she lay perfectly still, enduring. The lubricated interior of the dildo pulled and slid against Todd's engorgement. Delightful, heavenly. His fingers toyed with the rubber bulb in his left hand. Far away, Dusander recited pulse, blood pressure, respiration, alpha waves, beta waves, stroke count. As the climax began to build inside him, Todd became perfectly still and squeezed the bulb. Her eyes, which had been closed, flew open, bulging. Her tongue fluttered in the pink cavity of her mouth. Her arms and legs thrummed. But the real action was in her torso, rising and falling, vibrating. Every muscle, oh, every muscle moves, tightens, closes, every muscle. And the sensation at climax was ecstasy. Oh, it was. The end of the world thundering outside. He woke to that sound, and the sound of rain. He was huddled on his side in a dark ball, his heart beating at a sprinter's pace. His lower belly was covered with a warm, sticky liquid. There was an instant of panicky horror when he feared he might be bleeding to death, and then he realized what it really was, and he felt a fainting, nauseated revulsion. Semen. Cum. Jizz, jungle juice, words from fences and locker rooms and the walls of gas station bathrooms. There was nothing here he wanted. His hands balled helplessly into fists. His dream climax recurred to him, pallid now, senseless, frightening. But nerve endings still tingled, retreating slowly from their spike point. That final scene, fading now, was disgusting, and yet somehow compulsive, like an unsuspecting bite into a piece of tropical fruit, which, you realized a second too late, had only tasted so amazingly sweet because it was rotten. It came to him then what he would have to do. There was only one way he could get himself back again. He would have to kill Dusander. It was the only way. Games were done. Story time was over. This was survival. "Kill him, and it's all over," he whispered in the darkness, with the rain in the tree outside and semen drying on his belly. Whispering it made it seem real. Dusander always kept 3 or 4 fifths of ancient age on a shelf over the steep cellar stairs. He would go to the door, open it, half-crocked already more often than not, and go down 2 steps. Then he would lean out, put one hand on the shelf, and grip the fresh bottle by the neck with his other hand. The cellar floor was not paved, but the dirt was hard-packed, and Dusander, with a machine-like efficiency that Todd now thought of as Prussian rather than German, oiled it once every 2 months to keep bugs from breeding in the dirt. Cement or no cement, old bones break easily, and old men have accidents. The post-mortem would show that Mr. Denker had had a skinful of booze when he fell. "What happened, Todd?" "He didn't answer the door, so I used the key he gave me. Sometimes he falls asleep. I went into the kitchen and saw the cellar door was open. I went down the stairs and he... Then, of course, tears. It would work. He would have himself back again. For a long time, Todd lay awake in the dark, listening to the thunder retreat westward out over the Pacific, listening to the secret sound of the rain. He thought he would stay awake the rest of the night, going over it and over it. But he fell asleep only moments later and slept dreamlessly, with one fist curled under his chin. He woke on the 1st of May, fully rested for the first time in months.